True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
William Bradford Bishop Jr. was born and raised to succeed. With classic good looks, cultured parents, and a Yale education, he expected a lot out of his life. As an adult, he married a beautiful woman, and she gave him three healthy sons. They traveled the world, eventually settling into a Maryland suburb. Bishop built a career with the U.S. State Department, working in military intelligence. In his esteemed position, he felt in charge. But in his home, his wife and mother were running things. After 15 years of government service, Bishop was then passed over for promotion. His stalled career may have been the final indignity. Join us at the quiet end for the Bradford Bishop murders. 40 years have passed since this stunning case of family annihilation, and Bishop seems to have vanished from the face of the earth. The suggestive motives behind his crimes are as specific as they are unusual. Today we're taking a very deep dive into the psychology and sociology in Bishop's family life and career as they culminated in the brutal fatal attack of the people who loved him. And Dick's going to start us off right today with a beer.
A heavy hitter, guys. This one's called On Fleek, brewed by Stillwater Artisanal Ales in Baltimore, Maryland. As you mentioned, the bishops traveled all over the world, but I think they settled into a Maryland suburb. So that's why I took this beer. And like I said, it's a big boy. It's an imperial stout at a whopping 13% alcohol by volume.
Wow.
So I think we'll share this not just between the two of us, but among the other barflies that are sitting at the tables in the quiet end here.
Well, that's super nice.
Well, you know.
Yeah, let's do that. Maybe get some apps, too, around. Apps all around.
You got it. So this beer is a pitch black color. It's got a kind of an orangey head that quickly disappears. Nice aroma of chocolate and espresso. Taste is chocolate, dark chocolate, espresso, even a little molasses.
It's like a really good cookie for a person who likes to be drunk.
If you drink it fast enough.
Yes.
It's a very smooth beer. Very balanced. It's a nice balance between the sweetness of the beer and the char that you get in a lot of the stouts. So
it's great, a good one.
Great beer.
Yeah. Open it up and let's drink this thing. All right. Come on over to the quiet end. I'm going to give you a stool that has arms on it so you don't tip over.
Just tell them to grab the glass from me.
I got you covered, baby.
Okay.
All right, start us out with this story. It's an older story, happened a long time ago, but, you know, it's just fascinating. A very notorious person here.
He is, and we've had...
Colorado, Chris Watts. Yeah, we've also done John List.
I know, but what...
There's many.
Chris Watts is fairly recent, so I think...
Yes.
That's what makes me thinking of this.
Okay.
So William Bradford Bishop Jr. was born in 1936 in California, and he was an only child. His mother, her name was Lobelia Amaryllis St. Germain Bishop, was very attentive to him. And his father, William Bradford Bishop Sr., was this kind of laid-back guy who found success in finding and drilling for oil. Probably they had a fairly good life, at least as long as the oil was flowing.
Yeah, there was some ups and downs, a little bit of risk to it, but he just loved it. And he did well enough so they could enjoy most of the good things in life. They went skiing, camping, hiking. They lived in South Pasadena. And during Bradford Jr.'s childhood, the area was just filled with potential.
Yeah, the oil industry was booming. But even maybe more importantly, the film industry was starting to burgeon.
That's a big deal.
And they were close to Hollywood, so.
Especially for a young person, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
So Bradford Jr. was in a private elementary school called Polytechnic Elementary, but then he went to the public South Pasadena High School. While he was in elementary school, his mother would pick up him and his friends and take them to the beach. She was just full of energy and very involved in the socialite community of Los Angeles. She was the hospitality chair at a children's hospital. Ann Bradford Sr. was a member of the Pasadena Philharmonic Committee, and he became president of the Pasadena Civic Ballet. He really developed a love for ballet and got to know some of the dancers.
Huh. So Bradford Jr. seemed easygoing like his father. On the other hand, he's a pretty competitive kid and intense about this, and that was more like his mother. As he grew up, he was tall and pretty athletic, football player. He was even a quarterback, and what do quarterbacks do? They date cheerleaders. So this one was named Annette Weiss.
And she was very cute. She looked like the girl in Love Story. With Ryan O'Neill, what was that actress's name?
Oh, Ellie McGraw?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cute lady, yeah.
Oh, she was born in Toledo, Ohio, and her parents moved to California when she and her brother Robert were just young kids, and they lived in the Los Angeles suburb of San Marino. So Lobelia was not only a doting mother, but a doting wife as well. She kept a beautiful home. She got up first each morning, nice and early, to prepare breakfast and coffee. She did a lot of volunteering, and she took courses in cooking, language, art, and even floral arrangement. Her son, Bradford Jr., was an outdoorsman, but she also wanted to be sure he would grow up to be an intellectual.
Yes, yeah, so Bradford Sr. and Lobelia wanted Bradford Jr. to become a ballet dancer, but he preferred football. In his senior year of high school, he was elected class vice president, and he brought Annette home to meet his parents, and Lobelia bonded with her. She really liked her. She had similar looks, and the two shared an interest in art, and she liked how Annette always helped out around the house, preparing meals and cleaning up. And this was a time where most women were homemakers and mothers, and women did most of this stuff. So that's what they did. But, you know, the Bishop family was very impressive to Annette. They were a prominent family, but they weren't pretentious at all. Bradford Sr. was a patron of the arts and successful in oil, and Lobelia made the Los Angeles Times Society columns on a regular basis. As a high school senior, Bishop had his sights set on the University of Southern California in L.A., he could just see himself being near all of his old high school friends, going to the beach and playing sports. But his mom was thrilled when he was accepted into Yale University. That was more what she had in mind.
That's a pretty good place to be accepted to.
Absolutely.
Not that Southern Cal's a dump, but not quite as prestigious as Yale.
Well, especially back then when California wasn't as built up.
Right.
Yeah.
It was more the Wild West type of perception.
Kind of, a little bit.
So when Bishop enrolled in Yale, it was all male. And moving east to go to Yale was Bishop's first encounter with elite learning, living, and exceptional career opportunities. You bet. I mean, you can do lots of things with a Yale degree. So he got to live in Calhoun Hall, which was one of the most desirable dormitories. He tried out for the university football team, but was pretty hurt and unhappy to learn that the players had already been chosen. So he was fairly angry about this, and he called it a fix.
Yeah, the more he thought about it, the more it ate at him, and the angrier he became. He just didn't think that was fair. He did play some football, like on one of those intramural teams.
Yeah.
But that's not the same as playing for Yale. So that was a disappointment.
Well, he was a football player. It's not like he was just some scrub who hoped to make the team.
He'd been quarterback in high school.
Yeah.
But while he was at Yale, Bishop submitted some jokes to the Yale Record. But then he told his mom that he was on the magazine's board. But I don't think that was true. He was in the group photo of the staff, but he was listed as a contributor. And he only contributed in 2 issues over a full 5 years. So Yale wasn't really living up to his standards, or he wasn't living up to his own standards at Yale, if you know what I mean.
Well, he's come from being a big fish in this small pond to a little fish.
Yes, so even though he did well, he was never like the top guy.
No. I mean, he was not in any danger of failing courses, but he just wasn't getting the grades that he thought he should be getting.
He wasn't exceptional, and pretty much everyone there was exceptional. So when he visited California between semesters or over holidays, he was invited to parties. Lobelia made sure that he was mentioned in the social columns of the newspapers. She was proud that her son was a Yale student, that's for sure. But Bishop felt like he didn't stand out there like he would have if he'd been able to go to USC. So this position as an average student really bothered him, and he began suffering from insomnia. He ended up being prescribed a medication to treat his insomnia and anxiety, and this was Cerax. So this drug is a benzodiazepine, and this helped him fall asleep at night, but it also may have had some side effects. We'll get into that later because he stays on this medication for a long time.
Yeah, well, then the other thing about it, a lot of benzodiazepines, you get somewhat tolerant to them.
Mm-hmm.
So the same dose won't provide the same effects.
Especially after years of use, right?
Right?
Yeah. But life at the East Coast school wasn't what he really wanted. He actually had some trouble making friends with his classmates, who, you know, a lot of them came from New England families with old money. California had been different, and many of his classmates saw California as an uncultured environment. At this time, the hippie culture wasn't really a thing yet, and California didn't even have a Major League Baseball team yet. So to help him cope with his feelings of inferiority, Bishop claimed that he was a descendant of William Bradford of the Plymouth Colony, one of the original Pilgrims, and he felt like that might give him a little status at the school.
Well, certainly. Come over on the Mayflower, right?
And that wasn't that uncommon among the men there.
Oh, no.
No.
So Bishop Sr. had some financial hardship during younger Bishop's junior year at Yale, and tuition had been raised. A little bit of a problem, but instead of considering financial aid, Bishop took a year off. After a year of being gone, his friends were all graduating. In the fall of 1958, he did return to Yale, and when he was asked what he had been doing, he said, digging ditches. Because of his father's situation, he couldn't work for him and get paid, because there wasn't any money there. The best-paying short-term work at the time was digging trenches for the public utility companies. And
yeah,
he can make some pretty good money.
Well, sure, but I think he saw this as beneath him.
Well, of course he did.
It did pay quite well, but this was hard work. These were working men that did this, a totally different crowd. And hard work for him was humiliating. That's just the way he thought. Where you might think that's a commendable thing to do, he didn't see it that way. He saw it as a low-status job. So during that year off, he'd stayed at home and done that job and saved his money for tuition.
Okay, so he's back to school.
So he was quite disciplined about things.
And then in his senior year, Bishop learned all about existentialism in the literary course he took. He read The Outsider by Albert Camus, which focused on alienation and the meaning of existence. These are heavy topics, aren't they?
Pretty heavy, yeah.
At first, he couldn't understand it. How could life be without meaning? And if it was without meaning, why was he at Yale?
Yeah, why bother doing anything, right?
Yeah, we can carry that argument to that extreme,
right? You
can,
that's where it goes.
But it did make sense to him in terms of trying to figure out who he was and what his purpose was in life. And this appealed to him in his ongoing search for an identity. But the biggest influence on Bishop at Yale was nihilism. He read Nietzsche and liked his viewpoint that traditional values and beliefs were meaningless. He wrote about the Superman psyche and that these supermen would make their own values and follow their own path. These supermen might have to hurt people and be selfish, but that's part of the plan.
So this is important here, what you're saying, as far as the crime goes. Yes.
Right.
So we need to pay attention here.
Well, it did have a lasting effect on Bishop.
Absolutely.
And he carried these beliefs with him his entire life. Each goal he achieved was another step toward becoming the Übermensch, a new man, a superior man.
Mm-hmm. Well, Yale was well known for supplying the U.S. with diplomats and spies.
You can be a diplomat or a spy. What do you want to do?
And a Yale education could give one an entrance into Washington, Paris, and Moscow. So all that was required was ambition and the desire for the best of everything. So he had that. Bishop landed among the preppies of Eastern private schools, and these were young men who'd been born to parents who saw them as future leaders. One of them was Dayton Loomis, who shared a suite with Bishop during their final year at Yale. As seniors, the two young men got along really well. They went out for drinks and started spending long evenings discussing existentialism and nothingness, which was a topic in their French literature course. So even though it was trendy to be a bit depressed during this time, Bishop's focus on his own moods and his depression was very unusual. Part of his focus on this may have been due to his average performance at Yale, because average is never good enough for Bishop. He wasn't standing out there as he had in Pasadena, because everyone at Yale was above average. So even if you're above average, when you're with everyone else who's above average, you lose that.
Yeah, then you're just average again.
Yep. He didn't have the ego to really accept that.
Now, for his graduation from Yale, Annette and Bishop's parents flew out to be there for the commencement ceremony. And then after graduating from Yale, this was in 1959, Bishop married Annette. Then after their wedding, basically immediately after the wedding, he joined the U.S. Army. Now, in the 50s, there was still a draft. Even Ivy League college graduates had to serve. So he had enlisted at Fort Dix, New Jersey. Then he did his basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia. And he enrolled in the Army's Intelligence School in Baltimore. So in the summer of 1960, he went to the Army's Language School in Monterey, California, and there he learned Serbo-Croatian. He was assigned to the 163rd Military Intelligence Battalion in Europe, and soon his wife and son would join him. Bishop learned Serbo-Croatian at the Army Language School so that he could spy on Yugoslavia, and he would do this from being posted in northern Italy. By the time Bishop and Annette had arrived at the NATO military installation in Verona, Italy, they had a son, and this was William Bradford III. And in Verona, Bishop's job was to listen to Yugoslav radio broadcasts and military radio intercepts. That sounds really exciting to me.
Well, I guess it was really boring. American intelligence operations weren't so great after World War II, so when Bishop started out, the United States was actually still depending on the espionage network that had been set up by Reinhard Gehlen, the former Nazi intelligence chief. So the counterintelligence corps had kept up surveillance, but they often had to improvise, even working out of their cars sometimes. The operation eventually became part of the Army Security Agency. Just before Bishop completed his studies at Yale, the ASA announced a need for loyal U.S. citizens of good character. And they didn't care about grades, which was good for Bishop because his grades were, you know, A's and B's, just not exceptional. They needed people who could pass the intelligence test, which he definitely could do. The ASA was so secretive that personnel couldn't share any information at all, and they were expected to take any government secrets to their graves with them.
So is he going to be kind of a spy also?
Well, we don't really know because it's very secretive, right?
Yeah.
But there are
some... If I told you, I'd have to kill you.
Yeah, so there are some indications that he was a spy, but that's not written down anywhere for the public.
I'm sure.
So though it's known that Bishop posed as a Serbo-Croatian student, there's also some evidence that he served on covert missions. So these were on a volunteer basis, so this would have really appealed to the risk-taker in Bishop. And that's who Bishop wanted to be. This would have been a way for him to escape the boredom of listening to and analyzing the Yugoslav broadcasts day in and day out. So in his assignments in Ethiopia, Italy, and California, Bishop kept a diary. And this was a really interesting window into his fluctuating moods. He wrote over and over about trying to achieve excellence, confidence, and freedom to become really outstanding in the Foreign Service. And ominously, in an entry from 1967, he wrote, "Toxic, degenerative psychosis with confabulation, chronic low-level maniac, involutional megalomania." So we don't know what this was, if it was some kind of self-diagnosis, but later on we'll go into some more of these diary entries, which are just bizarre. There's really no other way to describe them.
Yeah, a troubled man.
Yes, definitely. It's a window into that brain.
Whatever inner turmoil Bishop suffered from, it was not well controlled when he arrived at his assignment at the U.S. Consulate General in Milan. So as the hub of Italy's northern business and fashion worlds, Milan was an important diplomatic post.
Oh, and what a great place to be posted, right?
Yeah.
Annette loved it. Bishop and Annette fit in well, joining a tennis club and skiing in Italy's northwestern mountains. Despite his athleticism and occasional likability, some of Bishop's colleagues in the Milan consulate noticed that he had an odd and kind of unappealing side to his personality.
Yeah, he could be quirky. I guess that's okay to say, but he could also be acerbic. One colleague remembered Bishop easily losing his temper when he missed a tennis shot. He'd get angry at himself, the ball, even the court itself.
That's a bad sign.
It sure is. Bishop also appeared to think that he was better than other people. This was obvious to a lot of folks. He could be shockingly arrogant, and any failure in his life, no matter how small it might be, could upset him. So Bishop Sr. died in 1969 after a fairly lengthy illness. Bishop Jr. flew out to California for the funeral, and his mother, Lobelia, didn't want to be alone. Remember, he's an only child, and she's just lost her husband of a lot of years.
Yeah.
So she didn't want to be alone. She ended up moving in with Annette and Bishop.
Well, and you know, she really liked Annette. She and Annette were kind of like buddies, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, they had a good relationship from the start.
Yes, probably better than Annette and Bradford Bishop had.
That could be.
But Bishop and Annette lived very well. But some of the people they worked around thought they had odd priorities. The couple lived beyond their means. They were able to because of his mother, Lobelia, providing extra financial support. Bishop seemed especially proud of his Yale class ring. He saw it as evidence of his success and even his worthiness as a man. But he was overheard raising his voice and insulting Annette a few times. He seemed to act as if her background was from a lower class than his, but that's not true. Bishop had a habit of leaving work early in the afternoons to go off and play tennis. But he was viewed as a good Foreign Service officer, and he did seem to work hard in the mornings. But it was just a little odd how brazen he was about taking all these afternoons off. Didn't seem to even think about it, which is unusual. Well, he's not self-employed.
It is unusual. No matter how hard you work, it's only half a day of work.
It didn't seem to be a big problem, I guess. He got away with it. But after leaving Italy in 1970, Bishop was sent by the State Department to earn a master's degree in African studies at the University of California in Los Angeles. So he could boost his career by specializing in a neglected area of U.S. diplomacy. And he did. It paid off quickly. He was made Deputy Chief of Mission, DCM, in Foreign Service parlance. And this was at the tiny U.S. Embassy in Gaborone, the capital of Botswana in southern Africa. But shortly before leaving Botswana, he wrote in his journal, "Try again, much harder, one last great effort. Come home." So it seems like he was kind of pushing himself to do certain things.
Yeah, so it seems.
But it's a little kind of crazy seeming the way he wrote things. Isn't like normal writing a sentence or something. It was kind of a bit much.
Like a stream of consciousness type thing.
Yeah, kind of. In a very like kind of demanding, almost hostile way.
Yeah. By the time this was going on, the family included now three sons, Brad III, Brenton, and Jeff. His mother, Lobelia, moved in with the family as well. Though Bishop took flying lessons, where he'd rent small planes to take trips around Botswana. But he and Annette both were seeing therapists, and he had begun taking antidepressants. His main complaint was insomnia, which it had been for years, and Annette was suffering from claustrophobia and anxiety, and complaining about panic attacks. One of Annette's close friends in Botswana, who happened to be another diplomatic wife, remembered both bishops as being pretty tightly strung. She said this was a tense family.
And I get that vibe.
I do too.
Just reading about them.
I didn't read the book.
Right. But when the Bishop family returned to America, they were ready to be back. Bishop signed into the Foreign Service Lounge in the main State Department building in Washington. 1974 was the 20th high school reunion for Bishop and his Pasadena High School's graduating class of 1954. The event was held at Newport Beach in California, and pretty much all of Bishop's elementary and high school friends were there, and it really ended up being a lot of fun for him and Annette. Now, Bishop had been looking forward to boasting about his successful career in the Foreign Service. He was proud of it, but the reunion took a downturn for him when he learned that some of his former classmates, or maybe even most of them, were making more money than he. He asked them about their salaries, and they were open with him. So he started going from man to man, asking them how much money they earned. So Bishop was making about $21,000, and his old classmates were making between $5,000 and $10,000 more than him. So I've looked it up, $21,000 a year in today's money would be about $120,000, somewhere around there.
It's not that much.
Not when you're living in Bethesda.
Yeah, it's an expensive area. But he wasn't making enough. Good thing his mom was around.
Right, it wasn't really a problem because his mother was there. But he did not like having his mother have control over any of his financial...
Oh, of course not.
Financials, yeah.
Bishop's classmates owned homes, and they made more money as their homes appreciated in value. Bishop could have been proud of his travels, worldliness, and his family, but he didn't see it that way. He only saw life as a contest, and this was a contest he was losing. He felt that he had to have done something wrong to end up behind the rest of his class.
So Annette chatted with an old friend, and the bishops were invited to a pool party at their house. At this party, Bishop continued to compare himself to the other men. So he's thinking about it, and he really has no assets. And being back in the Southern California society, all he could see is what the others had. Now, he had lived with servants, not having to pay any bills, having everything taken care of.
Oh, yeah.
With a lot of disposable income, even flying planes around. And he had memories of places and experiences that few of us will ever have in our lifetimes. He also had three great healthy children, but he still did not feel prosperous. Then it got worse. They were looking for a house in the Washington, D.C. area, but with inflation, they didn't have enough money to buy a house there. That's when Lobelia moved in, offering to move in with the family and pay for the house. Since Bradford Sr. had died, she didn't like to be alone, and Annette was thrilled with the offer. She and the kids liked to have Lobelia around. But for Bishop, this was just horrible, almost comparable to being neutered.
That's some comparison.
He did not want his mother to come in and take over that household. But at this point, he kind of felt like he didn't have a choice, because of course they had to be in a really nice house.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So Bishop bid on and was given a position at Maine State, where he would host diplomats and presidents. So this is more bureaucracy.
Absolutely, yes.
But he didn't like that. He thought the work seemed pointless. Still, he was where he needed to be in order to work toward upward mobility. He would need to be promoted in the next two promotion cycles. And if he wasn't, his career would be over.
Yes.
At least the way he looked at it.
Well, no, that was pretty much how it was. If you didn't get the promotion when the cycle came along, you were just out and you had to go find a whole different line of work.
Yeah. It's like some residency programs for doctors. They have more than they need and they winnow them out as they go along. So
you've spent years preparing for a specialty and then you can't do it.
Yeah. So you're one of 15 residents, first-year residents, and in the second year, they're only going to keep 10 of you.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily matter how well you do either. I guess if you're exceptional, it would matter, but just doing a good job wouldn't be enough.
Right.
So, yeah, that's a good comparison. Thank you, Dickie. That helps me just kind of see it more clearly. So, of course, his mother was in control of the household finances, and he really resented her for that, probably more than anyone knew. The family life increased his pressure to be promoted. His mother had paid $30,000 as a down payment on their house in the Maryland suburb, Cade Rock Springs. Having Lobelia living with them made Annette very happy. She could be relied on to take Annette's side in any domestic disputes. So they kind of, it seems like the two women would team up against him.
My own mother's against me.
Yep.
Oh, man.
But, you know, of course she was also a big help with these three active boys. Annette was even able to enroll in classes at the University of Maryland, work towards her master's degree in art, I believe.
Well, I could see Annette thinking she's in the best of all circumstances, right?
Except for her husband.
Well, but she's got this woman she really likes helping with the house. She's got a built-in babysitter. It really freed her up to do a lot more things.
I would think that Life was pretty good for her, aside from the fact, though, that her marriage was falling apart. And Bishop was on medication. He also tried hypnosis. Finally, he did go to see a psychiatrist. The one he chose, after pretty much interviewing a handful, was Dr. Frank Caprio. And this doctor had written a book titled How to Avoid a Nervous Breakdown. He had been an Army psychiatrist at Walter Reed, and Bishop met with him twice a week, which is a lot.
That is a lot.
But, you know, he had to be really careful because at this time, the U.S. Department of State would fire any employee who was getting psychiatric help. It wasn't allowed. But Bishop felt he was really on the edge of complete failure and that his family would no longer go abroad with him, so he couldn't do that either. When the 1974 promotion cycle passed, pressure increased, of course, and it was obvious to the psychiatrist, Dr. Caprio, that Bishop had status anxiety from his career and his unrealistic expectations at Yale. He had lived a life that most people would envy, but Caprio really needed him to figure that out on his own, and he just wasn't able to. Now that his mother was a daily presence in his life, his day-to-day life was often humiliating for him. So when Caprio diagnosed him with a mother complex, well, you can imagine that did not go over well with Bishop.
I'm sure he enjoyed hearing that.
But it seems clear that he did.
Yes, he did. So on the morning of March 1st, 1976, Bradford Bishop Jr. left his office at the U.S. Department of State early. This was around 5:30 in the evening. He complained to his co-workers before he left that he was feeling weird, like he had the flu. Now, this was Monday, and Bishop told his co-workers he might be back by Thursday. One co-worker told investigators afterwards that he had seen Bishop leaving the building Monday evening. He had spoken with him, and Bishop had told him he was very upset about not getting a promotion.
Yes, so they pretty much knew that's why he left early. They knew he wasn't on the list. Everyone saw the list.
Right. It's posted.
Yes, but he was really furious that day. The list of promotions had been released and his name wasn't on it. And he wasn't the only person, of course, that was left off of this list. But he was the only one to decide to go home and commit 5 brutal murders. So holding in his rage, Bishop stopped at the Sears department store, where he bought a 2.5-pound sledgehammer, a pitchfork, and a gas can. Then he withdrew the final $400 from his bank account. Next, he drove to Polk's Hardware and bought a shovel and a pitchfork. Then he filled the gas can at a Texaco station. After that, he drove home. Annette was making dinner. The 3 boys, 14, 10, and 5, were there. And the house was very tidy because Bishop always insisted it was kept that way, especially when he got home. The children were in their pajamas. Annette was still dressed in jeans and a jean jacket. So Bishop hid the sledgehammer in his briefcase, and then he put the briefcase up in his bedroom. His oldest son, Brad III, wasn't in bed yet, and this was likely around 8 p.m. Brad III was on the phone with his girlfriend, so Bishop picked up the extension and interrupted, pretty gruffly telling his son to wrap it up. So Brad III hung up and went to his room. Bishop waited until his mother took the family dog out for his evening walk, something she did every night. They had a golden retriever named Leo. Bishop changed into his pajamas, and once Lobelia shut the door behind her, he went back upstairs to get that hammer. The 3 boys were in their bedrooms, and then Annette was reading an art book for one of her classes. So her back was to her husband as he approached behind her with the sledgehammer. He caught Annette by surprise, and she had no chance to fight him or protect herself at all. He crushed her skull quite handily with that hammer.
Yeah, but he got a little bit thrown off in his timing because of Brad III being on the phone. Because of that, I mean, listening or trying to listen to what was going on with the phone, his mother, Lobelia, returned sooner from the dog walk than planned. So she comes in, she immediately saw, or maybe felt something, but she knew something was wrong inside the house. So she's still wearing her coat. She goes running into the family room, where she saw Annette on the floor in a pool of blood. And when she saw her son, she noticed that he was splattered with Annette's blood.
Now, can you imagine that kind of scenario? I just can't.
No, I can't.
Isn't that horrific? But Lobelia ran upstairs like a good grandma would, making some kind of effort to save those children. But of course, Bishop ran after her. She took refuge in the bathroom and locked the door, but then he smashed through the hollow wooden door quite easily. She wasn't a large woman, and Bishop was over 6 feet tall and about 180 pounds. Also, he was trained in hand-to-hand combat. He was able to reach his hand through the hole in the door and unlock the knob. So at autopsy, the medical examiner would conclude that the hammer to her head didn't kill her. Unlike the others, whose heads were just bashed in repeatedly, she only had one real strike to her head. And the medical examiner would think she died of fear, some kind of cardiovascular event related to the intense stress of being attacked.
Yeah, but he's still responsible for her death.
Oh, of course, yes. Absolutely. But it's just kind of strange he didn't take out the same kind of brutality on her as he did on the other family members. I think there's something significant about that, but maybe we'll talk about that if we have time in a little bit.
Okay. So 14-year-old Brad III heard the bathroom door being broken, and he got out of bed, confronted his father. But Bishop was pretty much at the height of his rage. He immediately attacked Brad, who was smaller than his father. Still, he put up a fight. However, he was no match for the fully grown Bishop. He smashed the boy's head with a hammer, and he did it so violently that a piece of Brad's skull would be found on the floor. He then continued his violent attacks. He went into the bedroom of his two younger sons. They somehow had slept through this stuff so far.
Well, let's just hope they slept through the whole thing and never knew what happened.
And he murdered them both in their beds with the hammer. He crushed his youngest son, Jeffrey's face so much that it was unrecognizable. And the blows were so violent that the hammer left dents in the ceiling above the son's upper bunk bed. One detective remarked on multiple hammer marks. Boys' heads had been struck multiple times.
Yeah, he just could not come to terms with that as a father himself.
Be tough.
So after these killings, Bishop showered. He was so covered with gore that pieces of bone would be found in the shower. He wrapped his family's bodies, wrapping extra towels around the boys' heads because there was so much blood coming from them, and he carried each family member out to his station wagon. The family dog Leo was spared, I guess because he couldn't talk and he hadn't really pissed him off.
Yeah, but he didn't just leave the dog.
No, he took him with him.
At least for a while. So he left his bloody pajama top on the top of the dresser, and he balled up his pajama bottoms and tossed them into the closet. He took out his favorite suit and his go bag, which was a bag of necessities that Foreign Service employees kept for emergencies. Inside the bag was his diplomatic passport, and he also took a Smith & Wesson .38 revolver with him. This had been left to him by his father. And he took a shotgun and extra ammunition. If he was caught, he's not going to go quietly.
I don't think so. So the bishop's station wagon pulled out of the driveway with Leo the Golden Retriever in the passenger seat. All of the stores and gas stations were closed by 10 p.m. back in 1976. Having Leo in the passenger seat seemed like a good idea to Bishop because when he drive through the tolls, where there were no cameras, there were actually people taking the change from you at the tolls, the dog Leo would serve as a nice distraction. Because the toll taker's going to look in and say, oh, look at the cute dog. They might glance in the back, but they're not going to give it too much thought. And they're not going to look too closely at the covered lump of bodies in the back of the station wagon. And we're talking about five people. This is stunning.
That's one word for it?
Yes.
So he's got the first step in his plan completed. Still had a lot to do. The first thing was to dispose of the bodies. And he was hoping that both he and his family would be assumed dead. No indication that he had any remorse, and in fact, he likely looked in his rearview mirror and felt anger and disgust for his whole family, because he tore the mirror off and threw it on the floor.
Angry man.
Angry, angry man.
So Bishop's station wagon arrived at the burial site before first light. He drove hundreds of miles. The area was near the Harvey Point Defense Testing Activity Facility, which was owned by the U.S. Department of Defense, and it was located on a peninsula in North Carolina. And he was familiar with this area. He'd heard that they really kind of keep people away from that facility. There was some bush there to conceal the bodies. He drove in just about 40 feet off of a logging road, and once parked, he planned to dig a hole and bury the family in a shallow mass grave. So Bishop dug just 3 feet down. He put his middle son in first, followed by Annette. Brad the third was put on top of his mother, and then Lobelia, and then little Jeffrey. And these people were not set gently into there. They were tossed, they could tell, when they found them. Lobelia was still wearing her fur-collared Saks Fifth Avenue coat. So Bishop smoked a cigarette and then emptied the contents of the gas can onto his bloody family. He lit a match and tossed it on the grave, but the flames caught onto the gas can and it singed Bishop's hand. The fire spread to some dead leaves and brush, so there was like a little bit of a forest fire there. So the plan likely had been to burn the bodies, just enough so animals wouldn't get at them and spread parts into the woods. But daylight was coming fast. He had to know he was running out of time to be on scene. By the time he drove out of the area, it was light enough for the car to be identified. So a witness saw a rust-colored station wagon pulling out onto the dirt road that morning at 6:30 a.m. There were rangers stationed there to keep a lookout for fires in the area. Ranger Ronald Brickhouse was called later that morning on his radio to check out the site where there was smoke coming from. So he pulled into the Bishop burial site around 12:40 p.m. When he got there, 3 acres were already burning, and this was a manageable fire, so he got to work extinguishing it. When the fire was mostly out, Brickhouse noticed a pile of dirt. Without that fire and the dirt pile, the bodies may have gone unnoticed for years. But Bishop had made mistakes. Brickhouse first thought that he'd come across a hog burning. So when diseased hogs die, the hog farmers would dig a shallow pit and set it on fire. The pit here could have held one large hog or several smaller hogs, and there were several hog farms nearby. But when Brickhouse approached the dirt pile, he stopped. He was just unable to register what he was seeing for a moment. There were human remains in the pit. At first he just saw the 2 top bodies, but then he realized this was several people. So Brickhouse radioed another ranger and the police were dispatched to the scene. And as he waited, he noticed that there was a gas can at the scene.
And even for experienced investigators, the scene was shocking and disturbing. Investigators found the gas can, the shovel, and a pitchfork. It seems like a mistake that he left these items behind. But on the other hand, Bishop had burned his hand, and he was likely in a hurry to leave before it got to be full daylight. And he also made the mistake of leaving one of his fingerprints on the gas can. Now, it had rained recently, so the area was pretty muddy. Brickhouse noted some fresh tire tracks on the ground. There weren't any reports of 5 missing people yet, but the bodies were identified as 2 women and 3 male children. The State Bureau of Investigation was called in to help. Still, it was going to be 8 days before the Bishop family was able to be identified. There were no missing persons cases in that area matching the victims.
So things didn't go according to Bishop's plan. He'd modified the plan quickly and hadn't thought it through. He very well may have had an accomplice after the fact. Author David Cassavis wrote in his book, The Bradford Bishop Murders, that Bishop likely met up with his accomplice in the Jacksonville area of North Carolina. So he would have contacted this person from a payphone along the way and likely arrived at Jacksonville before noon on March 2nd. So Bishop stopped at the outside sports store in Jacksonville between 5 and 7 p.m., and he made another mistake there using his credit card to buy $15.60 in sporting goods. The cashier would remember that one of the items was a pair of sneakers, and he described the man as middle-aged and wearing a suit. His face looked freshly shaved. He appeared very put together, so he hadn't slept the night before, of course. But he may have found time and maybe a place for a nap after he cleaned up. The cashier also remembered that Bishop had been accompanied by a Caribbean-looking woman, about the same age, who had the dog. The dog matched Leo's description, and later the witness would describe the woman as dark-skinned. He also said that the two looked like a couple. So back in the 1970s South, the term dark-skinned was commonly used to describe African-American people. Also, the witness said that the woman was wearing a colorful dress and she was holding the dog's leash.
So it's likely that Bishop rested for a day or two before leaving the Jacksonville area. He then drove about 6 hours to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. It's also possible that he played tennis, because he had bought tennis shoes near a courts in the area.
Well, that would be really strange.
Yeah.
But I guess not too shocking, considering.
During this time, he would also have had to fill the station wagon's gas tank. And he would also have to take Leo for a walk. Can't have him peeing in the car.
That's true.
So the Great Smoky Mountains Park was a popular vacation spot for outdoorsy types. Spring was just around the corner, so hikers and campers were going to be arriving fairly soon. The only entrance to the park was Elkmont, but it was pretty easy to enter the park unseen from other areas. It's March, there's not much going on. There were some homeless people living in the park, and it wasn't unusual for cars to be left parked there for a couple of weeks. So he's got a good plan.
Yeah, well, he drove into the deserted Elkmont camping grounds and parked in front of a boarded-up summer cabin. Elkmont was an old town known for processing lumber. A path called Jake's Creek Trail started at the cabin site, and from there, there was a network of trails in all directions. So Bishop would lay out a false trail for about a mile. He probably took Leo with him when he left the park. He was a loyal dog, and he might have just hung out around the station wagon if Bishop had abandoned him right there, and this would have gotten unwanted attention. If there was an accomplice waiting for him, he would have gotten into her vehicle and left with her. But this is the last time we would know of Bishop's location. At least one ranger saw the abandoned station wagon, and days later, some hikers reported finding Leo wandering loose. So a local family took him in. He was a good dog. Poor Leo.
Yes, I guess Leo's outlived his usefulness.
Yes, well, at least he didn't get smashed, huh?
Yeah, or shot or whatever.
Yeah.
So a park ranger saw the wagon on March 5th or 6th, somewhere around there. Then on the 10th of March, he saw it again. This time he called the police. The ranger reported seeing a bloody blanket, a hatchet, and a shotgun in the car. The plate number was run, and it was identified as Bishop's. By March 12th, the police would have a warrant for Bishop's arrest. The sledgehammer has never been found.
So it was a small boy who first approached the Bishop's home and saw that there was something wrong. He walked up the driveway onto the porch and rang the doorbell. As he waited for someone to answer, he looked down and saw dried blood on the doorstep. Also, there were days-old papers and flyers and mail building up on the porch. So he ran home to tell his mother, especially about the blood. So the neighbor went over to the house to check on the family. The side door, which opened into the kitchen, was left open, and there was a pot on the stovetop that had some food in it. So she just shut the door and left. She wasn't sure what to do. But no one had seen the Bishops in the neighborhood for about a week by then. They did travel, so this wasn't super alarming. Still, there was blood on the front doorstep. Maybe just a small amount, but still. So finally, she decided to call the police. A detective named Katie was driving nearby when he got the call to go to the Bishop's house. And this was just a routine welfare check. He wasn't thinking this was a big deal at the time.
Yeah, he'll get a shock.
He will.
So Cade Rock Springs was a 1960s suburban community. Crime was just not much of a thing there. So on March 8th, Detective Katie arrived at the house and saw blood drops leading away from the house across the porch and onto the driveway. There was a neighborhood babysitter who had a key, so the police were able to get inside. And once in, Katie saw the remains of the week-old slaughter. There was blood spatter, heavy blood spatter, on the walls, the ceiling, and the floor. There was blood, human tissue, and bone found, along with bloody sheets and pillows on the boys' beds. This is horrific.
Very horrific.
The Bishop family murders were understandably disturbing for the community of Cade Rock Springs. The neighborhood children had nightmares. Families shut and locked their windows and doors. And to make matters worse, three homes in the neighborhood were broken into a short time later. And then two police officers were killed on March 28th by a teenager who was running away from a bank robbery.
Yeah, so this was a tense time.
Holy cow, there's a lot of stuff going on all of a sudden.
Yes.
For peaceful little Cade Rock Springs.
I know it. So the police quickly put the Bishop home together with those five bodies that were found in North Carolina. And the family's babysitter was able to identify them from photos. The boys' bodies were wrapped in sheets, and Annette still wore her denim jacket. The medical examiner did the autopsies the day after the bodies were found, and he was surprised by the extreme blows to the heads of the boys. But fingerprinting of the bodies turned up nothing to help out. The shovel and pitchfork had been burnt, but OCH hardware could still be read clearly on the shovel handle. The police searched for a hardware store it could have been purchased from, and they found Polk's Hardware, so just the P had worn off the sticker, which was near Bethesda, Maryland. They were able to confirm that Bishop had purchased the items with his Bank America card at the hardware store, so investigators now believe that Bishop was responsible for these murders. And it was hard for a lot of people to believe.
I'm sure.
5 Bishop family members had been found bludgeoned and burned. The 6th family member, William Bradford Bishop Jr., was missing. So they didn't have proof that he was the killer exactly, but it was definitely looking that way. So TV vans and reporters descended on the main road into the Bishop's neighborhood. The Washington Post had the story of the killings on its front page. And the news was really a shock to the people at the State Department, as you can imagine.
I'll bet.
The Internal Security Service confiscated all important documents from Bishop's office then. They had to investigate if he was a security risk.
That's right. In North Carolina, authorities were overwhelmed with calls and reported sightings of Bishop, or of a station wagon. There was a waitress in Wilmington who waited on a man who tipped her $3, but he turned out to be a fisherman. There were rumors that Bishop had stowed away in one of the ships that departed from Wilmington that week, but every lead they chased down seemed to be dead end. By the time Bishop and his accomplice left the park and got on the highway, the sun was setting. The rough terrain of the park covered hundreds of thousands of acres, had wild hogs, black bears, and other wild animals living there. Many people had disappeared from the park in the past. One prime theory was that Bishop himself had wandered off and died. The other thing could be that he wandered off and killed himself, somewhere where his remains wouldn't be found.
Sure, you know, he was an avid outdoorsman and camper, but the found car pointed to his hiking into the forest and out of the park. That's if he didn't have an accomplice. But the trail had gone cold. The motives and planning by Bishop were a common topic of discussion, especially for people who had known the Foreign Service officer. Those who worked with him would say that Bishop wanted to be famous, and that he had significant delusions of grandeur. And he believed in putting people in their place. That was something he said often. So the culture of Foreign Service supported respect for succeeding and shame for any failure. Bishop felt like he had been failing at work and at home. His perceived success had been taken from him, and he felt worthless. He had been doing whatever he could to avoid being shamed and rejected pretty much all of his life. But now he had lost his social standing. So Bishop was indicted by a grand jury in Montgomery County just one day after the station wagon was recovered. On March 12th, an extensive search began in the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. 2 bloodhounds were brought in, and they picked up the scent where the station wagon had been parked, and they followed it to the cabin, then to the trail. They followed the scent for over a mile into the woods and then came back. Once they got back to the parking lot, they stopped at the "You Are Here" sign, and that's where the trail went cold again. And that's where the accomplice is believed to have picked up Bishop in her car.
So the FBI set up teams of 2 to 3 agents who went out to a 1-mile radius of the parking lot. An all-points bulletin was issued, and anyone who had been in or near the park that day was asked to come forward for questioning. A few different hikers reported seeing a man in street clothes carrying a duffel bag and tent. He was a sandy-haired man with about a week's growth of his beard. And a police officer from a nearby town reported seeing a suspicious man a few hours before the car was found. The man with the duffel bag was identified as a hiker who lived in North Carolina. So, still got a cold trail.
Yeah, but the car was filled with quite a bit of evidence. With the back seat folded down, they could see how he had transported the bodies of his family. Blood was streaked on the floor mats, and it had seeped into the spare tire well, where it had congealed. 2 blood-stained blankets had been used to cover the bodies, and there were other strange things he left inside, like a 12-gauge shotgun and a box of shells, an axe, maps of the eastern United States, and of favorite hiking trails in the Great Smoky Mountains. So inexplicably, Bishop had abandoned a suitcase full of clothes and toiletries as well, including shaving gear, a toothbrush, and a book of matches. A brown leather jacket was left across the front seat, and there was a brown corduroy jacket in the back. The ashtray was filled with cigarette butts, which in later years would be tested and would be positive for his DNA. In the glove compartment, he'd left a bottle of his antidepressant medication, Cerax.
By March 18th, the FBI revealed that Bishop had been under recent psychiatric care, and he had a prescription drug meant to control his condition. Flyers were distributed nationwide by the FBI, and they warned that Bishop was extremely dangerous and he may have suicidal tendencies. Herbert D. Clough, Jr., special agent in charge of the Norfolk, Virginia FBI office, said Bishop had been taking the drug Cerax under a psychiatrist's supervision. Without the drug, he said, Bishop gets extremely depressed. Bishop was described as a 39-year-old white male, 6 feet 1 inches tall, and weighing 180 pounds. Brown hair, brown eyes. The FBI also learned that Bishop had a pilot's license, although he hadn't flown in years. A wanted poster with 2 photos and a description of Bishop was created.
Yeah, and then the May 1976 issue of Inside Detective magazine featured the Bishop case in a story titled, Was This the Ultimate American Tragedy? It included photos of Bishop. It even had a picture of Annette's face from a morgue photo, and a state trooper and Washington County deputy looking down into the makeshift grave. So kind of a sensationalized story. But by mid-June, reporters had run out of new information. The attorney general announced that he was not sure Bishop had killed his family, but that if he did, he thought he was still alive somewhere. Maryland investigators believed that Bishop had taken his own life. The FBI and Montgomery County, Maryland police couldn't determine the motive for the killings, but they did find out he had marital problems, work problems, and financial problems. That $400 he took from his bank account was all the money the family had. So in early 1977, newspapers reported that Bishop had suffered from depression since before he even went to Yale, and that he had had chronic insomnia. Some of Bishop's closest friends couldn't believe that this handsome, intelligent, first-class Foreign Service officer could have killed his family. A few friends, including his wife's family, would never believe he was guilty.
Hi guys, Dick here. Jill said she thought it was time we put a new advertisement out, because she was bored with the old ones. First thing that came to my mind was what crazy stuff Jill was going to have me do for this ad. Previously, I've used a hammer, a blender, and fire. So in an attempt to avoid more craziness, I told Jill I would write the ad. Here we go. If you enjoy True Crime Brewery podcasts, but are irritated by the ads, you might want to consider becoming a member. For as little as $4 a month, you can listen to ad-free episodes and also have access to a bonus episode each month. Now that might sound pretty good, but there's more to this deal. When you become a member, you'll get some swag, like a snifter or a bottle opener or some coasters, plus some other stuff Jill likes to throw in. I think it's a great deal. All you have to do is go to the website, tygrabber.com, click on subscribe. It's that simple.
One year after the murders, investigators thought Bishop must have just flipped out. He'd been keeping his depression and his anxieties inside, and the fact that he didn't get that job promotion pushed him over the edge. He was turning 40 soon, and he may have felt that life was passing him by. He may have felt like a failure, and that it was the fault of his family members. The family had been good for his career when he was overseas, but back in Washington, he felt like they were holding him back.
He also is dreading the day where he's going to have to sit behind a desk in the State Department in Washington. This was from a former friend. He didn't like bureaucrats, and he didn't want to become one. Now, in January 1975, Bishop was assigned to be assistant chief in the Division of Special Trade Activities and Commercial Treaties. He was still in that job, with no hope of promotion, when his family was murdered. But Bishop hadn't just decided to kill his family out of the blue or in the heat of the moment. He had tried to hire 2 contract killers to impersonate gutter cleaners and kill his family while he was away on an official State Department trip to Switzerland. So these guys are a couple convicts, and they were to kill the family and make it look like a robbery gone bad. And then when he returned from the trip, someone from the State Department would meet him at the airport and give him the tragic news. All planned out. He had been prepared to act stunned and devastated. And he was confident in his ability to elicit sympathy, and he was ready to play the role of the grieving husband and father. Only one small problem. When the plane landed February 8th, he was surprised that no one was there to meet him. And as he pulled into his driveway, he knew the killers had backed out. He went into the house, and his very much alive wife told him that the gutter men had not shown up. So we gotta bide our time and make a new plan now.
Yeah, but he made this plan quickly, maybe too quickly. First, he sent a letter to Bankston, the man responsible for setting up the contract killers, and he hoped that Bankston could find him an accomplice. Bankston wrote to Bishop twice to tell him that the accomplice was a woman in a North Carolina prison. After the failed attempt at having his family murdered, he wrote to Bankston about dumping the bodies in a lake. So he was consulting this Bankston as a co-conspirator. But as far as we know, Bankston just wanted to plan his own jailbreak. So he went to his office on Saturdays, and he had access to the blank passports there. In March of 1978, investigators admitted that they were no closer to finding him. The case was still open, but they were no longer actively looking for evidence. The State Department officially terminated the diplomatic career of Bishop at that point. So the department believed that he had left the country, but his passport had not been used. But he had access to blank passports.
Yeah,
he could have done that. And the ink they used, yes.
So in June of 1978, a sighting of Bishop came in from the Netherlands. There was a man being held hostage by terrorists. That guy was believed possibly to be Bishop. However, the hostage turned out to be a Dutch taxi driver.
Yeah, there were a lot of these sightings that came to nothing.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
Now, they developed three major theories about the case. One was that Bishop was the sixth victim of a murder plot against the entire family, but his body was obviously disposed of in a different location.
Yeah, but there's a lot of evidence against that happening now.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And why would you pick a different location?
Well, it's possible if killers had come and killed the family and then taken him somewhere else to get information or something. But
okay.
The evidence does not point in that direction.
The second possibility was that Bishop killed his family and escape by leaving the country.
And that's what most people have believed.
And then the third possibility was that he killed his family and then took his own life in a remote location.
So that's possible, but there's no evidence that he did that. In January of 1979, the Associated Press reported that police believed the most plausible theory was that he had completed an elaborate plan to disappear. Some officers believed he planned his disappearance by preparing one or more fake passports to travel abroad. They also believed that he had changed his appearance. The AP reported that the FBI and police in Sweden were looking into a report that Bishop was seen in Stockholm during the first week of July in 1978. An old friend of Bishop's had seen him on the streets of Stockholm several times, he said. A woman who claimed to have seen Bishop in Stockholm said she was a close friend of the Bishop family when they were living in Ethiopia. So the Stockholm sightings were the strongest lead the FBI had received since the murders. Again, didn't lead to anything.
Right. In 1982, Harry Stapleton wrote the longest and most detailed account of the entire Bishop mystery in the Virginian Pilot. Again, no new leads. Stapleton wrote another update in March of 1986, on the 10th anniversary of the deaths. The only new lead then was a phone call the week before to the Montgomery County Police from a man who said he had spoken with Bishop in a southwestern state.
Yeah, so the Bradford Bishop case was cold for over a decade. Then in 1991, the investigation was taken up by Montgomery County's Sheriff, Ray Kite. In 1992, Sheriff Kite did a random search of credit bureaus and got a possible lead. A man in Sacramento, California, had the same Social Security number as Bishop's. But then it turned out that the man had died. Also, the photo of this guy didn't look anything like Bishop. So they don't know how he ended up with that Social Security number. Kite assigned a deputy and a detective to the case, and they looked into two Bishop files that were at the State Department, and they found a letter. The letter was a piece of registered mail addressed to Bishop, and the letter had Marion Federal Penitentiary in Marion, Illinois, as a return address. So this is where Bankston comes in. The letter came from a convicted bank robber named A. Ken Bankston. The letter itself was pretty shocking. It suggested that Bishop may have tried to find a professional hitman to kill his family, and that Bankston was part of the network he was using to plan the murders. Bankston's letter was marked number 6. In his writing, Bankston referenced letter 4 and letter 5, which suggested a trail of correspondence between Bankston and Bishop. Bankston mentioned a series of names and places connected with North Carolina, including some areas that were super close to where the Bishop family was buried and burned. Bankston wrote that a man named David Paul Allen knew someone named Sonny in the federal penitentiary in Atlanta, where Bankston had once served time. He knows all about Cresswell, wrote Bankston. Cresswell is only 9 miles from Columbia, where the Bishop family bodies were found. So Bankston's letter also mentioned a woman who was in the North Carolina State Penitentiary. So was there a woman in North Carolina that Bishop was trying to hook up with after the murders? And was she the woman seen with Bishop while he bought the sneakers in Jacksonville, North Carolina? Curiously, Bankston's letter was dated March 15, 1976, which would be 2 weeks after the Bishop family murders.
Huh.
So did Bankston not know? We don't know. Yeah. It's strange.
Very strange.
But it was a real departure from what was already known about this case. With the letter written in 1976, not being found until 1992, of course, there's a big question now, why hadn't it been found and investigated earlier? But the FBI claimed that Bankston's letter was investigated. The FBI's Maryland field office chief said an investigator called the Marion prison officials back on March 23rd of 1976 and was told that Bankston wrote all kinds of crazy letters. They said he was always looking for an angle to improve his life and maybe get a trip out of prison. So according to the FBI, Bankston wrote to government officials often. Based on that, the investigator in 1976 just dismissed Bankston as a nut job. And it seems like maybe that was done a bit prematurely.
Might have been.
Still, the Montgomery County investigators had doubts about the FBI's version of this, because Bankston himself was never even interviewed. The plot behind his letter died with him because he died in 1983. So with Bankston out of the picture, his letter just bred confusion and supposition.
And the letter's information, whether it was true or not, led investigators to begin work in the federal prison system. Interviews were done with convicts and their relatives. Bankston's letter never specifically mentioned a murder plot, but he did mention a guy named Sonny and a man named David Paul Allen as possible accomplices in something that led investigators into a search for connections. The search for Sonny ended with a federal prisoner who admitted having connections with murder plots set up by the Aryan Brotherhood and the Dixie Mafia. But the prisoner gave investigators nothing to confirm a plot to kill the Bishop family. This is going to turn out to be all smoke.
Well, I don't know if Bankston's smoke. I think there's something to that.
Can't ask him.
No. So David Paul Allen was interviewed 4 times, and he claimed to have connections and inside knowledge. Allen knew inmates connected to the Aryan Brotherhood. He said he had heard about a murder-for-hire plot to kill Bishop's family, and that someone named Bishop had paid $25,000, along with some valuable jewelry, to have his family murdered. So some sources also suggested that the deal included help hiding Bishop and getting him away after the murders. But then the killers backed out. As far as the shooter was concerned, Allen told the cops, they took this guy's money and some of his wife's jewelry and didn't do the job. The whole deal, he said, was arranged by a woman who had been in prison in North Carolina. So that sounds familiar.
Yes, it does.
When asked how a Yale graduate working at the State Department met a bank robber like Bankston, Allen just said, "A murder makes strange bedfellows."
Well, that's just a stupid comment. Come on. That doesn't explain anything.
No, it doesn't. But it is kind of true. It's not an explanation, but it's a true statement.
Well, okay, I'll give you that. Now, investigators have never found this mysterious woman. Just 5 weeks before the murder, Bishop attended a one-week trade meeting in Geneva, and he spent a couple of days at a nearby Swiss ski resort. And while there, he was seen on the slopes with a woman who wasn't his wife. And according to some former friends, Bishop and the woman were part of a bed-hopping pre-conference sex party scene.
See, that's a whole new phrase to me. Bed-hopping pre-conference sex party scene.
Yeah. It works, huh?
Yeah.
By this theory, the murders should have happened while Bishop was out of the country. Then when his hired killers backed out, Bishop was left to commit the murders himself. The speculation that he had help in the murder, or his subsequent escape, was promoted in 2013 by an informant from a Virginia motorcycle gang. But this is getting more strange and convoluted.
Well, it is, but as a reliable source living under the Federal Witness Protection Program, the informant knew a woman who worked at the State Department, and she was in contact with the motorcycle gang. This woman was having an affair with Bishop, he said, but she was also having an affair with a gang member, so that could be where the connection came in. She was the accomplice after the murders, and the gang assisted Bishop to escape the country. Now, one big problem with this story was that Bishop didn't seem to have any money to finance this plot, which would have cost quite a bit of money.
Yes.
They wouldn't be doing this for free for him.
Uh-uh.
But investigators who had a long-running relationship with that informant insisted that that source was completely unimpeachable. They'd used him for many things, and he'd always been right. So you have to give it a little bit of believability just on that.
Well, you have to chase down the leads or the information, see
yes.
if you can verify things.
But I mean, just from someone reading about the story, I would say it's a possibility. I wouldn't write it off completely.
I think you could say that. On March 19th, 2000, Lorene Klepacki of Asheboro, North Carolina, bought an old diary for $38 at the Super Flea Market at the Greensboro Coliseum. And on the first page were the words, Bradford Bishop Diary. So her son found the name on the internet, and they called the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office. So the diary covers a six-year time period from October 65 to October 71 and begins with a quote from Walt Whitman. Afoot and lighthearted, I take to the open road. On June 12, 1968, Bishop writes, one should seize upon life and embellish it. He discusses his career, writing in February 1967, if you're going to succeed in the Foreign Service, which would be to make ambassador before you're 50, hold positions of responsibility, constant dedication and considerable sacrifice of time and thought are required.
So in all of the diary, there are two references to one of his sons and no mention at all of Annette, which I think gives you some idea of where his mind was at. It was not with his family.
Absolutely.
In 68, he writes about his insomnia. He writes, this accursed insomnia. It's amazing, despite how lousy you feel, all doped up, smoking a few cigarettes, etc. His problem, he wrote, must be overcome with love, style, and self-satisfaction. So the writing goes from neat and to almost illegible, with about a four-year gap before the last entry, which was on October 23rd, 1971. So that's kind of weird. And at that point, he wrote, your family grows more beautiful, and you still stand on the threshold. Outwardly, your accomplishments are great. My, such symbols, promotions, citations, languages, degrees. Still, you stand on the threshold. You have soared to the heights and plummeted each time to the depths. That's pretty good.
It is.
Over the years, the media exposure has resulted in thousands of tips, especially from the America's Most Wanted episode. There was one tip from Arizona about a homeless man living in a shelter, but that wasn't him either. There were also some unidentified bodies. One John Doe, who washed up in a sail on the coast of Hyde County, North Carolina, in April of 1987, seemed like he could have been Bishop. He had no teeth left, and his hands had been cut off at the wrists. but a coroner's report identified him as Native American, so that eliminated him as bishop. Then in 2002, someone from the Hong Kong police said they'd found a body in a fishing area and that the fingerprints identified him as bishop. But that one turned out to be a hoax.
Another tip, and this one about a recluse living in Moose Lake, Minnesota, came in after Bishop's picture appeared in Reader's Digest. Now, this guy was clearly hiding, and he looked similar to Bishop. But as it turned out, he had reason to hide. He'd been involved in crimes in Minnesota and was taken into custody, but he wasn't Bishop. In 2014, the FBI teamed up with forensic artist Karen Taylor. She created a sculpture of Bishop to portray how he might look at age 77. There was also digital imaging to show pictures of him with different hairstyles, facial hair, and glasses.
And that same year, Bishop was added to the FBI's 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list. But then, in 2018, he was removed from the list, and he was replaced with someone they considered a more dangerous fugitive. The FBI said in a statement that it was replacing Mr. Bishop, who would be 81 years old at that time, because they no longer believed publicity was going to help in his capture. There have been no confirmed sightings of Bishop since his initial disappearance, the FBI said in a statement, adding that his continued presence on the 10 Most Wanted list is not expected to result in any additional information that might lead to his capture. So in my mind, Bishop suffered from a pretty serious mental illness. His prescribed medication had some side effects too, right?
Right.
So with CRAX, your side effects can be confusion, unusual risk-taking behavior, hyperactivity, agitation, hostility, and hallucinations. So if that did have a role in the murders, it was not a good role. It was not positive, right?
That's correct, yeah.
So the book I mentioned earlier in the show, written by David Cassavis, had some interesting takes on the department-wide dysfunction in the Foreign Service. The dysfunctional culture includes status anxiety, which we did touch on a bit, and this originates from the promotional system, which can make you a success or a complete failure in the eyes of your coworkers, and you really have no control over that.
In the Foreign Service, there is existentialism, which is a theory that an individual is a free and responsible agent who determines his or her own development through determinate acts. So this, mixed with existential angst, can cause extreme anxiety, despair, or hopelessness with the idea that life lacks meaning.
And we know that's something that he dabbled with way back in college.
Very into it in college.
Yeah.
So a man on the verge of turning 40, Bishop would also be vulnerable to midlife transition issues, like boredom, discontent, restlessness, irritability, anger, sadness, sexual affairs, and increased or even decreased ambition. Now, none of these explain Bishop's horrid actions, but it does give us some insight into what he was thinking and feeling leading up to and during the murders.
So, we've discussed family annihilators before, including Chris Watts, Robert Fisher, John List, and Christian Longo. In every case, power and ego provide the foundation for their decision to kill. The role as father in the family is crucial in their perception of their own masculinity, and the murders themselves are like a final attempt to just assert themselves and be the man of the house. The four types of family annihilators are the paranoid offender, who perceives an external threat to his family, and he's motivated by a twisted need to protect his family. The anomic type of family annihilator is interesting. These are men who link their family to their financial success or failure. The father sees his family as the result of his economic success, and then if he's a failure, the family's lost its function. They're just no good to them anymore. The disappointed annihilator believes that his family has let him down, or they have undermined his vision of what the family should be. So this brings to mind the annihilator in the horror film, The Stepfather. Great horror film in the 80s, and I think there was also a remake in the early 2000s. But this guy would move from family to family, and when each family didn't live up to his ideals, he'd kill them and move on. The self-righteous annihilator is the final type, and this killer puts blame on his spouse for his perceived breakdown of the family. So these guys may have called the mother of their children and told her what he's going to do. These guys base their own self-worth on whether they can financially provide for the family, and they may resent a working wife or even blame an estranged wife.
Yeah, this makes me think of a crime that happened just this past February, a couple months ago. There were two girls whose mother was at work, and while she was there, her husband of 30 years, their father, David Kayser, killed the daughters, 19-year-old Clarissa and 14-year-old Crystal, in their home in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, the wife called the police so they could do a welfare check because her husband had threatened he was going to kill their kids and himself. She added that while she was on the phone with him, she heard what sounded like a gunshot, and then he said, "How do you like that?"
Oh, that is God. Gives me chills. It's awful.
Police went to the home, and when they went inside, they found the father, who was 56 years old, and his teen daughters, all shot dead. The couple was having problems, and he apparently wanted to hurt his wife in this very cruel way.
That is like the worst thing ever. So at this point, Bishop could very well be dead, right? Even from an accident, suicide, or even an illness, because he'd be turning 85 years old this August.
Yeah.
So it'd be a miracle if he was ever located at this point. You know, I just think he had an advantage because he was an experienced world traveler with access to passports and government connections. Most people don't have that.
No, they don't.
So it's easy to blame the murders on his mental health problems and the lack of a promotion, but there's got to be more to it. He could have been in love with another woman, and he seemed fed up with his career prior to being overlooked for that promotion. He had seen his career and financial failures coming for quite a while. And he had felt like his wife and mother were controlling him. As far as his children go, they no longer served their purpose for him. He didn't need the diplomat's family anymore. So it was an incredibly selfish and egomaniacal act, in my opinion.
According to the book's author, Cassavis, the key to finding Bishop is in knowing where to look. He wrote that it is a Foreign Service officer trait to think that the second 40 years of life will be more interesting than the first 40 years. If Bishop wanted to leave a legend behind, that would have been a very Foreign Service thing to want. Failure was never part of his mother's plan for him. The hierarchical system and the elitism in the U.S. Foreign Service could have taken a mild, normal resentment and cranked it up into the intense rage against his family.
Well, yeah, that author really seemed to think that was a huge influence on him more than anything personal or from his childhood. So that's a really interesting thing if you want to find out more about that. The book is just phenomenal. It must have taken him years to write it. Again, it's titled The Bradford Bishop Murders by David Cassavis. Very much recommended. If you've got the patience and want to learn, there's a lot to it. Other sources were the Washington Daily News Archive articles by Don Baker. Also an article titled Familicide, The Killing of Spouse and Children, written by Margot Wilson, Martin Daly, and Antoinetta Danielle from the Department of Psychology at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. There's another book, which I read quite a bit of as well, was very good, A Killer in the Family by Peter Ross Range. TCB's music was written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you have any comments, a case suggestion, or even a good beer recommendation, please send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tygrabber.com or go to our website and write your comments there, or better yet, leave us a voicemail. Your voicemail may be played on an upcoming episode, and we would just love to hear from you. If you'd like to get your future TCB episodes commercial-free, get an extra members-only episode each month, get a free beer glass, bottle opener, all kinds of swag, you might want to consider subscribing as a Tie Grabber at tiegrabber.com. Also, if you enjoy the show, we would very much appreciate you leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen to True Crime Brewery. So, Dickie, bring in the feedback. Let's have a look.
Feedback today, I got a couple voicemails that I want you to listen to.
Yay.
The first one's from Jordan, and he has a case suggestion.
Hi, Dick. Hi, Jill. It's Jordan. I have a case suggestion for you. It's the case of Paul Bernardo and his wife, who is Carla Homolka. They were a duo that raped, and they brutally raped people in Canada. They committed their first murder. The victim's name was Leslie Mahaffey. on April 16th, 1991. It was a pretty sadistic murder. What happened was Paul Bernardo had sexually assaulted Leslie Mahaffey, and then he strangled her and then dismembered her and put her in a bunch of slabs of brick and dumped her by a river. The next year, I believe it was April 19th, 1992, Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, they had kidnapped Kristen French. They had held her for a few days, sodomized her, and then they strangled her, and they dumped her nude body in the forest. Then after that, they tied the rapes and murders to Paul Bernardo. And Carla Homolka had mentioned that she had been a victim of spousal abuse from Paul Bernardo, saying that he was a sadistic monster, which he was, and seemed like she was a victim. But during the trial, it showed that she was a willing participant in these horrible crimes. And Paul Bernardo got sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And she got only 12 years, and she is now living free under an assumed name, which bothers a lot of people because, you know, she'd helped commit these horrible crimes. So those are the case. That's the case suggestion. Hope you have a great day. Bye.
Thanks so much, Jordan. So I guess it's tough for equal rights, even in crime, right? Women get treated differently.
They do. And we've had a lot of people that have suggested this case.
Yes, it seems very notorious. And I have to say, I don't know a lot about it, but I do know it has been recommended. I think we should do it this summer.
We probably should.
Yeah.
So we'll get into that. The other thing, one of the victims was Carla's sister.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Who was murdered. And there were rapes kind of before he graduated into murdering people.
Uh-huh.
And there were attempted rapes. This guy's got a sordid long history.
It sounds horrific.
So, but yeah, let's look into that.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, next we have a voicemail from...
We have a voicemail from sisters, Johanna and Abby.
All right, let's hear the girls.
Hi, Jill and Dick. My name is Johanna, and I'm here with my younger sister, Abby.
Hey.
Abby introduced me to your podcast, and we're big fans, so we wanted to leave a voicemail together.
We're here in Austin, Texas, and wanted to call you with a case suggestion, as well as a couple of your suggestions. We love for you to cover the murder of Penny Skaggs by her husband, Roger. This crime took place in 1996 in our community, and we personally knew several of the Skaggs' neighbors.
Yeah, one of my closest friends lived on the same street as the Skaggs and had known them a long time. Ironically, they were the couple she called if her parents were out of town and she got scared. She had started college and moved out that year, but she happened to be there the night of the murder and was as shocked as everyone else on the street to see the police cars and crime scene tape going up at the Skaggs' house. That night, several neighbors, including my friend and her family, gathered in another neighbor's home to support Penny's husband slash murderer, Roger.
Roger claimed he came home from work late to find his wife next to her canary yellow baby grand piano in a puddle of blood where she liked to sit and play after dinner.
According to my friend, Roger did seem pretty shaken up, like someone who had just found his wife's body or someone who had just murdered his wife. He also mentioned her wedding ring was taken, which, as my friend commented, in retrospect, seemed an odd thing to notice at the bloody scene of one's dead spouse.
Now, this is your classic divorce is not an option, so I'll go ahead and murder case. The Skaggs had one daughter, and they were empty nesters. They'd been married for like 35 years. Roger was having an affair.
Of course.
And Penny would likely never have consented to a divorce. The couple was super religious and active members of their church. Penny actually taught a course providing biblically based guidelines for wives, which focused on a wife's duty to respect and obey her husband, including important tips like, if you suspect your husband's having an affair because he stays out till the wee hours of the morning, be sure to greet him at the door with dinner at whatever time he gets home, because it's best not to greet insult with insult.
Gross.
There's lots to unpack in this case, Jill. There's an article from the Austin Chronicle about this case called Murder in the Suburbs, Good Luck, Penny, a book entitled The Good Wife, The Shocking Betrayal and Brutal Murder of a Godly Woman in Texas, as well as a Dateline episode that we couldn't find, but perhaps y'all have better luck. Now, I'm a margarita girl, but I'll turn it over to Johanna to talk beer.
Thank you. I have a couple of beer suggestions from local breweries. First, a beer named for a particularly winding stretch of highway in the Hill Country, Devil's Backbone from Real Ale Brewing Company in Blanco, Texas. The name of the beer is a bit nostalgic for us, since Abby and I grew up driving along the Devil's Backbone to our grandparents' lake house. I love Belgian-style beers, and this is my favorite triple and the beer I always keep fully stocked in my fridge. And I'll give you one more suggestion, since there's no shortage of crimes here in Texas. Although I'm not a huge fan of IPAs, I do like Stash IPA from Independence Brewing Company in A-Town.
That's all for now. Hope y'all are doing well.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, gosh, thanks, ladies. That was amazing.
They're full of energy, aren't they?
And so organized. They had their thoughts all laid out, what they were going to say.
Yeah.
And yeah, just wonderful. Thank you so much. And that does sound like a great story. Those are my favorite ones where divorce is not an option, so I have to kill them.
Yes.
I think we kind of lean towards liking those, or maybe I'm pushing us in that direction. But
combined with the church and the religious aspects.
That's another one, yeah.
So
yeah.
I thought you would like that.
I did like it very much. Thanks. Thanks, ladies. Great job.
And I'll have to find some of those beers.
Oh, sure. Yes.
Especially the triple. I like Belgians. So, good suggestions. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much, guys. We really appreciate it. Going kind of long again today, so we're going to wrap things up. And we'll see you next week at the Quiet End.
We'll save a seat.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys. Thank you.